Brandenburg.
Please stand by. We're about to begin. Thanks so much for holding, everyone. Welcome to the Davis Wright Tremaine LLP New COBRA Rules Require Prompt Action Conference Call. Just a quick reminder, today's call is being recorded. And now at this time, I'll turn things over to our host, Mr. Jeff Buffiglio. Please go ahead, Jeff.
Thank you. Welcome to the Davis Wright Tremaine Teleseminar. I'm Jeff Buffiglio. In just a second, I'll turn it over to Liz Deckman to do our introductions. But first, wanted to let everyone know that we will be trying to handle questions by email during the seminar. So if you have questions, please email them to hrseminars@dwt.com. That's hrseminars@dwt.com. We'll try to handle a few questions for each speaker, that questions that come in that are pertinent to that speaker, but we'll probably save both of the questions for the end of the presentation. So I'll turn it over now to Liz Deckman.
Thanks, Jeff. On February 17, 2009, President Obama signed into law the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act. The act provides for a subsidy of 65% of the employee cost of COBRA coverage for some qualified beneficiaries who've lost health coverage due to an involuntary termination of employment that occurs during the period beginning September 1, 2008 and ending on December 31, 2009. The subsidy is paid for by the federal government. However, plan sponsors have significant new COBRA premium and notice requirements under the act. For example, plan sponsors and administrators may be responsible for determining which employees are eligible for the subsidy. They must provide new COBRA notices, and they need to administer the new COBRA rules in general. The premium reduction became effective generally March 1, 2009, and revised COBRA notices must be sent by April 17, 2009. This means that employers must be ready to act quickly to establish an approach to deal with these new requirements. This teleseminar will inform you about the new requirements and help you begin creating a compliance approach that works for you. The teleseminar will begin with a summary of the most important new rules affecting COBRA. The topics to be discussed include the following. First, Stuart Harris will discuss which employers are affected by the act and when. He will also talk about what happens if there's a failure to comply with the new COBRA rules, and he'll also explain the expanded COBRA election rights. Holly Klein will then discuss the premium assistance provisions of the Act, and Jason Froget will wind up with the Act's new COBRA notice provisions. As Jeff indicated, we'll be discussing these new rules as outlined on your handout for approximately an hour, after which we will be answering email questions from you. In addition, we will take a couple of questions at the end of each speaker's session. So, Stuart, why don't you start off?
Okay. Thank you, Liz. As Liz mentioned, this new act was signed into effect February 17, 2009, and a couple things are striking about it. I think the first thing we want to address is, and one of the main questions people are asking, is does this apply to me? Am I covered by this? The act is unique in that it does apply to more employers than a lot of employee benefit laws have typically applied to. And what I mean by that, for example, ERISA applies to employers other than governmental employers or church plans. This act focuses on employers or basically covers employers who sponsor group health plans that are subject to COBRA, and COBRA, the rules for COBRA appear both in the tax code and in ERISA. They also appear in what's called the Public Health Service Act, which applies to state and local governments. So in effect, the employers affected by this act will be private companies with 20 or more employees, since they are subject to federal COBRA, as well as state and local government employers who are going to be subject to COBRA-like continuation rules under the Public Health Service Act. The federal government, as an employer, is also involved or covered by this law because for these purposes, a group health plan includes the federal government group health plan. And then in addition, the law did something a little bit, what I find unique. It reached out to plans that are not typically covered, that are not covered by COBRA or the tax code, but are covered rather by what the law refers to as COBRA comparable coverage. Now, what that means is state laws that are often referred to as mini COBRA laws. So various states, pick an example, Oregon, Washington, they have laws which will say, or they're intended to affect smaller employers, less than 20 employees, so they're not covered by traditional COBRA, and it will apply the rules, COBRA-like rules, to those group health plans. And typically the way the states do this is by addressing or requiring insurers that are issuing policies in that state to effectively hardwire the continuation rights into the policies themselves. So what the Act does, it says if you've got a plan that is covered by one of these COBRA comparable laws, such as a state mini law, then you too have to comply with the Act. Now there are a few plans though. We are on slide four. As speakers, we'll try to announce which slide we're moving, since you have handouts. So moving on to slide four, talking about plans that are specifically exempt from this law, from the Act, and there are a few. Health spending accounts, they are exempt, which wasn't really surprising since they get some exemption under ERISA as well. Health flexible spending accounts, so FSAs, under Section 125 cafeteria plan, they are exempt and are not considered a group health plan for purposes of the Act. You could also get plans, for example, a church plan, which is excluded under ERISA as well as the COBRA requirements of the tax code. It would be excluded if it were in a state where the state either did not have a mini COBRA law, or the mini COBRA law did not apply to church plans, which is the case in some states. So those would be the plans that are specifically excluded from the provisions of the Act. In dealing with plans that are excluded, we've gotten some questions, or some clients have asked me, well, what about if I have a plan that's, say, a vision-only coverage or dental-only coverage? Is that still covered under the Act? Is that considered a group health plan? And the answer to that is yes. I think what employers want to do is look at any plans that they have for which they have COBRA coverage duties, and that can be a fairly broad category. For example, it could pick up health reimbursement accounts, some employee assistance plans, even some wellness plans may fall under the COBRA umbrella, and since they're not specifically excluded under the Act, they too would be covered. Moving on to slide five, the effective dates. As Liz mentioned, the law was signed into law February 17, 2009, but it says it's applicable for periods of coverage that begin after that date. Now, in most situations, the period of coverage, for example, your traditional health insurance program, is going to be a monthly period. And so we're looking, for practical purposes, we're dealing with coverage that begins March 1, 2009. It's possible that you could have a group plan that had a shorter period of coverage. Maybe it was broken up into a semi-monthly or biweekly, something like that. But for most plans, and virtually all that I've seen and addressed, the period of coverage would be monthly, and so we're talking March 1, 2009. Note that, as some of Jason and Holly will talk about later, there are other specific effective dates. As Liz alluded to, the premium subsidy affects participants who had a COBRA event between September 1, 2008 and December 31, 2009. So there's a period of coverage there. And as well, the right to, as we'll talk about here shortly, to get extended COBRA coverage, or effectively to be able to take a second shot at electing COBRA, the effective dates for that continue, but they're tied somewhat to when the employer sends out the notice, which we'll be talking about. Now, as is always an interest, people will be asking, well, so what bad things can happen if I don't comply with this new law? And there are a number of bad things, unfortunately, that can't happen. The legislative history to the law, this is moving on to slide six, talks about how a violation of the notice, the new notice requirements that we'll be talking about, will be considered a violation of the COBRA notice rules under both ERISA and the code. And under ERISA, a violation of the COBRA notice violations, or a COBRA notice violation, can trigger a $110 a day penalty. Under the tax code, there's a $100 a day penalty for COBRA violations. Under both ERISA and the Public Health Services Act, which again might affect some of the employers that will be subject to this act, there are potential other potential lawsuits, including a lawsuit under ERISA. You can bring a claim for what's called other equitable relief. So the thought would be, if someone is harmed some way, they could bring a claim to say, I should be put back in the position that I was in. And so that will depend on facts and circumstances of what the person's claiming, how they were in fact harmed. So I think the bottom line is, there's not only potential fees owed to the government, but there's potential liability to participants who can show that they were harmed by either not getting a notice or being deprived of rights under the Act. Now, moving on to slide 7, let's talk a little bit about the extended COBRA rights, because as Liz mentioned, that's one of the primary things that this Act does. Effectively, what it does, and I'm going to use a definition here, which then Holly shortly will define and flesh out. The Act looks at what they call an assistance-eligible individual. So that means someone who fits a category where they are eligible for the premium subsidy. Now, with respect to what we call the extended COBRA rights, the Act says if you are an assistance-eligible individual, or an AEI, you have the opportunity to, again, elect COBRA. Now, this right extends to people who either did not elect COBRA the first time when it came around, or maybe who elected COBRA but then let it lapse for whatever reason other than exhausting their COBRA rights. So if they fit into that category, and on the date that this law came into effect, so February 17, 2009, they do not have COBRA coverage, they can come back in and elect to start COBRA coverage up either for the first time or start it up again. Now note that this extended COBRA right applies to plans that are subject to traditional COBRA, either under ERISA or the tax code, or local or governmental employers who get it under the Public Health Services Act. It does not give a new election right to that group of employers who are subject to the mini COBRA laws. So if you are an employer, say typically a small employer in a state like California or Oregon, where they have mini COBRA laws, you will be subject to this act. You have to comply with the premium subsidy, but because the COBRA rights in effect are arising under state law, you do not have to give the participants a new opportunity to elect COBRA. So if they previously did not elect, let's say someone terminated employment in last November, and under state law, under the mini COBRA laws, they could have elected continuation coverage, they did not. This new law will not give them a second bite of the apple, so to speak. For those people who have the right to elect the expanded COBRA coverage, that right effectively begins February 17, 2009, and continues for 60 days following after receiving the appropriate notice from their employer. And Jason will be talking about how the notices go out and what the notices entail later in the program. Again, I want to emphasize that the election right is available to the AEI, or the assistance-eligible individual, even if they didn't previously elect COBRA, or if they previously elected and let it lapse. So again, going back to my example, someone who terminated employment back in November and never elected COBRA. Perhaps they didn't think that they could afford it, or just didn't think they needed it. If they fall into that category of being an assistance-eligible individual, now under this act, they can come back in and say, yes, I will now elect COBRA. Similarly, if they elected it and then let it lapse, either they didn't pay the premium or they decided, no, this is too much, I don't really need it, again, they have a second bite of the apple. Moving on to slide 8. Now, I have a comment for some of you. Some of the early PowerPoint presentations, or if you've got a PDF of our materials, an early version that went out contained a typo, for which I am solely to blame. My colleagues didn't do this. I did. Although I think we all looked at it. It's amazing how many people can miss a typo. In the first bullet point, it talks about, it has the date February 17th, 2007. That should be February 17th, 2009. So again, there, if elected, the new COBRA begins with the first period of coverage on or after February 17th, 2009. As we talked about, that's generally going to be the month of March, so starting March 1, 2009. Now, this new COBRA opportunity, it doesn't reach back. So going back to my example of someone who terminated employment in November of last year, and they say they didn't elect COBRA, and it turns out they racked up some hospital bills and they wish they had elected COBRA. This law has passed. They now have an opportunity to come in and elect COBRA again. They can do that, but they can't elect COBRA retroactively and say, yeah, I want to go back and pay the premiums and pick up the claims for November, December, January. It doesn't reach back. It just goes forward. Similarly, this act doesn't extend the COBRA coverage that the person would have. So, for example, traditional COBRA upon termination of employment, that gives you 18 months of coverage. This person's 18 months of coverage would have started tied to their COBRA triggering event, which would have been back in November, and they would get their 18 months there. The fact that they're now getting a second chance to elect, effectively beginning, for practical purposes, March 1, 2009, isn't going to extend that 18 months. They just get the period of coverage that they would have had. A couple other points, moving on to slide 9. The Act also addresses how this new election affects pre-existing conditions and a plan's ability to exclude for pre-existing conditions. Under HIPAA, there were rules that prohibited plans, in most exceptions, from excluding for pre-existing conditions. And what the law effectively says is that if you are making this second election and electing COBRA, then those same rules apply. So it's as if you were starting fresh. Also under HIPAA, there was the concept that if you'd gone for longer than 63 days without group coverage or creditable coverage, that they call it, then a new plan could impose its pre-existing condition requirements. And under the Act, it says that for someone who is electing, taking the second chance to elect COBRA, the new plan has to disregard any gap that they have for purposes of that 63-day rule. So effectively, you look back at the date when they originally had their COBRA qualifying event up to the date when they commence coverage under their new expanded election rights, and you ignore that period for purposes of looking at whether they had creditable coverage. So that's how the Act tries to blend COBRA and the HIPAA rules. Before I turn it over to Holly, any questions, Jeff, that you want to ask at this point, or the people have emailed?
Yes, we do have several, three of them that seem to be most pertinent to yours. First, for people who came on the line late, let me repeat that you can send your questions by email to hrseminars@dwt.com. So let me get to three questions. We have two people ask, how does this apply to EAPs, Employee Assistance Plans?
Oh, you weren't supposed to ask hard ones, Jeff. Not all Employee Assistance Plans would be subject to COBRA. So I think that the thing you have to look at is this an Employee Assistance Plan that's going to be covered by COBRA at all? And to make that determination, you're looking at whether it's a plan that provides group health type benefits. Some employee assistance programs merely are referral agencies. They just kind of tell the participants where they can go to get the help. There are some employee assistance plans that may provide certain types of counseling or therapy, which would fall into the category of a health or welfare benefit. Those types of plans would be considered a group health plan. And so would be subject to the law because they would be technically subject to COBRA. Now, the difficulty with this type of plan, though, is figuring out, you know, what's the applicable premium. So if someone wanted that sort of benefit, they could continue to participate in that plan to get those types of services, provided that they pay their share of the applicable premium. And in my experience with employee assistance plans, it's somewhat difficult, and in part because the IRS has not given really clear guidance on plans like this, how you calculate the applicable premium. And also in my experience, once you figure out what the applicable premium is or make a good faith effort to calculate that, and then you tell the participant, here's what you have to pay to continue getting these services, it often just doesn't make sense. They can get the services on their own for the same amount or cheaper.
So basically it has to be an EAP that's subject to COBRA and then handle the same as the other premiums. We also had a couple of questions to clarify the small plans, which states have these mini COBRA laws. We know that California is probably the primary example of one that does have a mandatory mini COBRA law.
California does. Oregon does. I mean, I don't, and that would be a good question, which I actually can't answer to give a kind of all 50 states list. But I know offhand, California has mini COBRA laws. Oregon has mini COBRA laws. Washington does not. Now, another question that I've heard asked is some people will say, well, don't all states have mini COBRA laws? And the answer is no. I know that they do not by virtue of the fact that I know that Washington does not. Most states, and perhaps all states, have in their insurance laws some sort of conversion right where someone who's in a group health plan once they leave can convert their coverage into an individual policy. But that's, for purposes of the Act, that's not considered mini COBRA. That's not a COBRA comparable type of right. So you would really want to find the state, if your state has a state continuation mini COBRA type claim. And if you're a small employer, you know, you should know that.
Okay. And final one, what if someone at the time that they terminated elected dental and vision coverage but not medical coverage? Will they now get the second chance to elect medical coverage under COBRA?
That's a good question, and yeah, I'd say yes. They get a new opportunity to make that expanded election. Okay, and I will turn the time or the mic, I suppose, over to Holly, and she will be starting on slide 10.
Good morning. So as Liz and Stuart mentioned, the new law has two, if you look at it from a very broad view, two main aims. One is to provide employees with a new COBRA election period, and the second is to give them some financial assistance in paying those premiums. And so I'll be talking about how the payment of those premiums work, who is eligible for premium assistance, and also how the employer reimbursement from the federal government works as well, and how the reporting and the tax aspects of that work. So the assistance-eligible individual, the AEI, we know pays only 35% of the COBRA premium, which leaves us to the question, you know, where does the other 65% of the COBRA premium come from? The employer or the insurer picks up the remaining 65% and is later reimbursed by the federal government. And we'll go into a little more detail about the mechanics of that, but I wanted to do a brief overview of how the premium assistance and the reimbursement work to start with in this section. The AEI, the assistance-eligible individual's 35% of the premium, can be paid by a third party, such as a parent or a guardian if the AEI is a child, or a state agency or charity. But when the employer pays the a portion or all of the AEI's premium, that's when we get into some, it gets a little more complicated, and we might get into a situation where the subsidy is decreased or unavailable. And we'll talk about, in the context of severance agreements, how employers can restructure their payment of COBRA premiums to maximize the subsidy for both themselves and the employees. As Stuart mentioned, the premium subsidy continues for up to 9 months. And moving on to slide 11, we'll talk about what are we paying, what 35% of what. We know under the normal COBRA rules, you can still charge 102% of the applicable premium, and that stands under the new legislation. So the AEI's percentage is 35% of what the plan charges. So essentially, it's 35% of 102%. Because this legislation is so fast-moving and it's got such a short fuse, it's already March and April, and you may be wondering, and I'm sure Liz and Jeff are getting these questions, what about folks that are already going to have paid their full COBRA premium in March and April? What if AEIs have already paid? And the legislation contemplates that and says that you have two choices. You can either reimburse the 65% of the premium that the AEI is not responsible for, or you could credit them, credit based off of future premiums that will be coming in, if it's reasonable that that will be run out in 180 days. So you can either refund or credit them going forward if they've already paid in March and April. As we mentioned, issues arise if the employer pays a portion of the AEI's COBRA premium. It's often the case as a matter of company policy or in the context of a severance arrangement that the employer will offer to pay all or a portion of the employee's COBRA premium. And in that case, if you have a premium of $500 and the employer pays $100, for example, the AEI's portion is 35% of $400, and so the subsidy would be $400. So the subsidy would be 65% of $400. So the concept here is that when the employer pays a portion of the COBRA premium, the AEI's portion, the portion that's subsidized, is only what is charged to the AEI, only what is charged to the individual. And at the end of this section, we'll answer some questions that have arisen about how that works in the context of severance arrangements and offer some guidance on how those arrangements can be restructured to maximize the subsidy. Moving on to slide 12, we're going to talk a little bit about the time frames for the subsidy. The subsidy, as Stuart mentioned, begins on the first day of the first month for the period of coverage beginning on or after February 17, 2009, which for most folks will be March 1st. The subsidy ends, and this is where it gets a little more complicated. The subsidy ends 9 months after the first day of the first month of coverage. Remember, it's a 9-month maximum subsidy period, regardless of the COBRA coverage period. The subsidy ends at the earliest of 9 months, or the date following the expiration of the maximum COBRA coverage period, because we know that the subsidy doesn't extend the length of time the individuals are eligible for COBRA. It just subsidizes a portion of that time. Third, the subsidy can end at the time that the individual becomes eligible for coverage under another group health plan or Medicare. And these are major group health plans. These are group health plans other than dental, vision, counseling, referral services, or FSAs, or on-site medical clinics. So the onus is on the individual to let the plan or the employer know when they become eligible for other coverage. And the IRS has made that clear in imposing a penalty on individuals of 110% of any premium reduction that they shouldn't have received beyond the date when they're eligible for other coverage. So, again, the subsidy begins for most folks March 1st and ends at the end of 9 months when the maximum COBRA period ends or when the individual becomes eligible for other coverage. Moving on to slide 13, who is eligible? What group of individuals can take advantage of the subsidy? We know that qualified beneficiaries are eligible for the new COBRA subsidy if they meet three requirements. First, they must be eligible for federal or state COBRA at any time between September 1st, 2008 and December 31st, 2009. Second requirement is they must elect COBRA. They can either do so when they were first offered, or, as Stuart mentioned, they could do so during the extended election period when they get a second bite at the apple or a second opportunity to elect COBRA. The third requirement is that they must have been involuntarily terminated between September 1st, 2008 and December 31st, 2009. And this third requirement is where we have the most questions and the most confusion arises. So if you've got someone that's eligible for federal state COBRA after September 1st and elected COBRA or left COBRA during the second election period and was involuntarily terminated, they're going to be eligible for the COBRA subsidy. The questions we get revolve around what is involuntary termination? Is death or disability an involuntary termination? And the answer there is no. If someone goes to part-time employment, is that an involuntary termination? No. If someone is fired, is that an involuntary termination? The answer is yes. An involuntary termination is kind of the key eligibility piece. And one little caveat is that if someone is involuntarily terminated for gross misconduct, then they will not be eligible for the subsidy. So that's one little carve-out we wanted to bring your attention to. Moving on to slide 14. With the subsidy, there are certain individuals that will not be eligible. In looking at the overall policy objectives here of providing some assistance to folks who need some help after a layoff or an involuntary termination, government is excluding individuals with over a certain income level. So we have some income limits apply to the premium subsidy. And if a taxpayer's income exceeds $145,000 or double that, $290,000 for joint filers, then the amount of premium reduction is going to have to be repaid. So essentially that means that if you make over $145,000, not eligible for it. You can still get it, but you'll have to repay it. And then if an individual makes between $125,000 and $145,000, there's a phase-out. There's a kind of an incremental amount that of the premium assistance that is eligible, available for that individual, but a portion of it will have to be paid back. So in order to avoid the administrative headaches of having someone with income over $145,000, you know, take the premium reduction assistance and then have to repay it through their personal taxes, high-income individuals with income over $145,000 or $125,000 can permanently waive the assistance by notifying the entity to whom the premiums would be paid. And again, we've had some questions about whose responsibility is it to monitor the individual's income and determine whether or not they're eligible for the subsidy. And that, again, falls on the individual. That's the onus of the individual to inform the plan of their eligibility or ineligibility for the subsidy. Here on slide 15, we answer some questions about who is eligible for reimbursement of the subsidy. The federal government reimburses the 65% that the employer pays for the COBRA coverage, and it's typically the employer that receives reimbursement in most cases, but in some cases, depending on the facts and circumstances, the insurer will be eligible for the reimbursement. It's basically the entity to whom the premiums were paid is generally the entity to whom reimbursement will be due from the federal government. The way the reimbursement works is the 65% or the part that the employer, the insurer, has paid for the AEI's premiums can be reduced from the entity's payroll taxes. And the way that works is on the IRS form 941, which are the employer's quarterly federal tax returns. There are new sections 12A, 12B, sections 13 and 14, that contain boxes and spots for you to, for employers to show the amounts that have been paid and the individuals that they've been paid for, and the payroll taxes for that entity will be offset by those amounts. In some cases, there are not enough payroll taxes to offset the amount the employer will have put forth to subsidize employees' COBRA premiums. In those cases, the excess amounts will be treated as credit, or employers will be eligible for a straight-out refund of payroll taxes. On slide 16, we wanted to discuss briefly the documentation process necessary to secure reimbursement. That includes in Form 941, the information is fairly straightforward, what they're asking for. And one of the key pieces is an attestation of involuntary termination of employment. And then, as I said before, this is kind of the key factual determination that's kind of the first step that employers will take in complying with this new law is to determine what is the group of people who has been involuntarily terminated since September 1st, 2008. And that's one of the pieces that the employer or the insurer will be filling out on Form 941 to report and become eligible for reimbursement. Again, the report will show the amount of the payroll taxes offset. It will include the tax identification numbers of affected former employees. And it will also include the amount of the subsidy reimbursed for each former employee and dependent. And that concludes our brief discussion and overview of how the premium subsidy works and who is eligible and how the reporting and reimbursement process works on the employer side. A couple of questions that we've received. The first, as I said, revolves around how to determine whether or not an individual has been involuntarily terminated for purposes of being eligible for the subsidy. And the answer to that is really a facts and circumstances determination. It depends on what the agreement or what the documents around that termination show. We know that death or disability or an individual going to part-time employment don't constitute an involuntary termination employment. And we also know that an involuntary termination for gross misconduct excludes the individual for eligibility. But other than that, you've got to look at the facts and circumstances around the individual termination or the termination of a group if it's consistent across. And that will help you determine whether or not the individuals are eligible for the subsidy. A second area where we've received a number of questions is in the area of severance agreements. Often employers pay a part or all of an employee's COBRA premium for a period as provided in a severance agreement. And you know, the way that a good takeaway here is to know that if an employer subsidizes COBRA premiums in that way, they're going to reduce or not be eligible for the subsidy, the federal subsidy that we're talking about. So what we are advising some employers to do, one option is to restructure severance agreements so that the employees, you know, receive a lump sum that is not tied in any way to COBRA premiums. And in that way, whatever COBRA premiums the employee pays, 65% of that can be reimbursed from the federal government, and the employee only pays 35%. And because there were a lot of numbers involved there, I'd like to give a quick example. If a severance agreement provides that, so an employee is involuntarily terminated, has a severance agreement, the COBRA premium for the period would be $1,000. As part of the severance agreement, the employer is agreeing to pay half of that, $500. The assistance-eligible individual would pay only $175, which would be 35% of $500. They are only eligible for the subsidy for the portion that that the employee pays. So the portion that the employer subsidizes is not eligible for reimbursement from the federal government. So again, the way that we see employers responding to this is to not to remove any piece of the severance payment from attachment to COBRA premiums, and then that allows the employee to pay the full portion and the employer to receive reimbursement of 65%. That concludes the subsidy portion of the Artello seminar. And I will pass it on to Jason Frobrick. Oh, we've got some
additional questions.
I didn't answer them all.
There are quite a few questions. Well, there were quite a few questions about involuntary termination, and I think you clarified that quite a bit. We did get several variations on the question of if the employer does not pay for dependent coverage normally under the health plan, and then a person is entitled to COBRA and they're dependent, they can choose dependent coverage. Does the dependent coverage also qualify for the subsidy? And
I think, yeah, the answer is yes. It does, you know, the portion of whatever rights the employee has to add dependents or exercise, the portion of the premium for those benefits is going to be eligible for the subsidy.
It just seems a little strange, I think, to people, since the employer wasn't paying anything before, and now they have to sort of front 65% and then get reimbursed. So, but that is the way it works. Also, several questions along the lines of your situation with the severance, where the agreement was to pay for COBRA premiums for a certain number of months, 3 months or 6 months or something like that. And this could be for people who terminated previously, sometimes since September of 2008. And they've used up those months of subsidized coverage. Would they now be eligible for the subsidy?
Yes, they would. Through their election, they would be eligible for the subsidy for the portion that the employee is paying. So when, say, the employer is going to pay 3 months or 6 months of COBRA premium, when that period ends and the employee picks up their payment of COBRA premium, they'll be eligible for the subsidy at that point because they, not the employer, are then paying the premium. It's important to keep in mind in that context, though, that the subsidy overlays the maximum COBRA coverage period. So if the COBRA coverage period is ending, the subsidy is not going to extend that at all. It simply overlays it.
Let's see. There's another question. If people who are terminated, say, after March 1st, does the subsidy period extend for 9 months from the time that they begin COBRA? So it really could extend beyond December 31 of 2009. Is that correct?
It is correct. The COBRA, the maximum COBRA subsidy period is 9 months, and that can begin at any point after, February 17th, and it can begin at any time before December 31st, 2009. So it could theoretically begin December 30th, 2009, and continue for 9 months.
Did you have a question? Oh, okay.
So I think that concludes the subsidy portion, and we'll move on to a discussion of the notice requirements with Jason Brogan.
Thank you, Holly. As Holly indicated, I am going to talk about the new notice requirements. I tend to think of COBRA generally as having two primary requirements. The first is to make continuation coverage available, and then the second is the notice requirements that are imposed on employers. And although this new law adds some wrinkles to that, certainly the premium subsidy and getting reimbursement for the employer are new obligations for the employer. Generally, I think it's useful to keep in mind that the way COBRA works, for the most part, the way it's always worked, the way you've always known it to work, is the way that it's going to continue to work, certainly for notice purposes. So keep in our mind that we all hopefully know how COBRA works, and although these are new wrinkles, they work primarily the same way. So what are the new notice requirements? The first notice requirement that I'm going to talk about here, starting on slide 17, we refer to as the premium assistance notice. And you notice I put that in quotations because that's not really a technical term. And it's something actually that a lot of my clients use much more colorful language to refer to. But however you want to refer to this, the idea is that you have to provide notice that this premium assistance is available. And that notice has to go out to anyone who is a qualified beneficiary, who became a qualified beneficiary between September 1, 2008 and December 31st, 2009. And I want to make a specific point here. There are different notice requirements that apply to different individuals. And so when I say here, we've talked a lot about assistance-eligible individuals. When I say here that the notice has to go out to all qualified beneficiaries, that's what I mean. So regardless of whether or not they had an involuntary termination, you have to provide them notice of this premium assistance availability. If they didn't have an involuntary termination, they're not going to be able to elect it, but you have an obligation to provide this notice. And you know, as and that's and then we'll talk. I'll talk a little bit later about the idea of who has the right to make an election. But I want to start with this idea that you're going to be providing notice to all of these individuals, and that may be that may be a really large group of employees, depending on your or former employees, depending on your employee pool, but it's not just the former employees, and I think again this is consistent with COBRA generally, but you know you may have to track down other qualified beneficiaries, spouses. Covered children who are dependents, anyone who's going to qualify as a qualified beneficiary generally. And this notice is going to have to be provided generally by April 17th, 2009. There's actually a wrinkle here. The legislation doesn't specify the date that you have to provide this notice to people who aren't eligible assistance eligible individuals. But I think conceptually it makes sense for us to use that date to satisfy this notice requirement. The legislation specifies that you can satisfy the notice requirements by either amending your existing notice or including supplemental information in the notice with respect to premium assistance. The way I think about this is essentially we are just adding new information to our existing COBRA notices, and our COBRA notices change occasionally because of our administration, or because of a change in the way the plan operates, or however you want to look at that—a change in law. And this is obviously a change in law that affects the way that our notices read. The big change, of course, here is that some of this is retroactive and some of it is sort of prospective. But what I want to keep in mind is that there's two pieces here. So what I've been talking about is the premium assistance notice, the information that has to go out to all qualified beneficiaries. I'll talk in a minute about the election notice. So what are the specific new notice requirements for what I've referred to as the premium assistance notice? On slides 18 and 19, we have a list of those specific requirements, and I'm going to gloss over that for a specific reason, which is that the Department of Labor is going to provide a model notice. So I think for most of us, it's not that important what's specifically required by the legislation to be put in these notices, because the Department of Labor is going to give us a template, give us a model notice, and that's going to be deemed to satisfy the requirements. But it's good to have this information, and now you have this information in the form of the PowerPoint slide. So if you need to go back and look at it, or if you need to refer to it in any way, you'll have that information in front of you. One thing I do want to highlight, though, that shows up on the slide is that your notice it must include any forms that are necessary to establish eligibility. So if you are going to ask individuals to make an attestation about involuntary termination, or if you're going to ask questions about their eligibility for other coverage or something else that might disqualify them from being an assistance eligible individual, then you need to include that form. We don't know yet what the model COBRA notice will look like. Maybe it will include that information as well, but I think that's important to keep in mind, especially because different plans, you may elect to administer your plans in different ways, and so that may be an area that you either need to tailor the notice for, or just come up with a specific form. With respect to the model notice, I'll note that it should be coming out, or it's required by the legislation to come out by March 19th, which is a week from today. And a lot of my clients, they say, well, what do we do if the model notice is not provided by that time? And, of course, I say, it's the Department of Labor. What do you have to worry about? They're always on time. So they're like the Italian train system, or is it the German train system? I don't know. The Department of Labor is like a train. That's the important thing to keep in mind. Once we get the model notice, then we'll be able to make some determination as to how best to integrate that with your current COBRA administrative procedures. My expectation is that you'll be able to use the model notice with probably just a little bit of tailoring with respect to your specific plan. So the next thing I want to talk about is the selection notice, and so we'll pick up back on slide 20. And as I said, the legislation sort of talks about the premium assistance notice and the election right or the election notice as two different things. And conceptually that could be true. The important thing for us to know is that while everybody, all of the qualified beneficiaries or everyone who becomes a qualified beneficiary between September 1 and December 31st of 2009 will have to get notice about premium assistance. The election notice, or the people that you allow make an election, is a subset of that. Those, and the subset is just individuals, are just the assistance eligible individuals that have been described, that Holly described in detail. And again, the important, the key characteristic being involuntary termination, qualified individuals who become qualified beneficiaries because of an involuntary termination during those or in between those dates. So what that means is that conceptually you could limit who you provide the election notice to that subset of individuals. Whether that makes practical sense or not, it's going to again depend on the way that you administer your plan. It may make the most sense to send out the information and the election forms to everybody, include enough information so that they can make a determination as to whether or not they are eligible themselves to make this election, and effectively satisfy both requirements at the same time. If you choose not to do that, if you choose just to limit who you provide the election notices to, that's fine, but you then are sort of shifting the burden or taking on the burden or responsibility for making that determination of who is an assistance-eligible individual. And as Stuart made reference to, the risk there is potential penalties under the tax code and under the labor regulations. And of course, if someone, the real risk that if someone chooses not to elect during this new special election period to get COBRA coverage, then you could end up on the hook for paying their medical bills. That's oftentimes the real stick of COBRA administration, is that if you make that determination wrong and someone isn't entitled and someone doesn't elect COBRA because they didn't get the proper notices, you may be on the hook for providing their coverage. So, as a practical matter, again, weighing what else is out there in terms of of your other administrative responsibilities, I think it probably makes sense to provide both notices or a combination where you tell everybody about the premium assistance and the ability to elect, and then allow them to make their choices. And if the people who are choosing when that comes back to you are inconsistent with the information that you have, that is, if you have people who are who left voluntarily who are trying to elect, you can handle that on on the back end. So the period, the election period. This notice, as I indicated, has to go out by April 17th. That's really the hard deadline under the legislation. Otherwise, that notice, the election notice, is going to be treated exactly the same as your regular COBRA election notice. If you're generally administering COBRA, so they're going to have a 60-day period in which to make the election. There's not specific guidance on how the premium payments work, but again, I would just sort of analogize it to your typical COBRA election notice. So they'll have a 45-day period after they've made the election in order to sort of make up the premiums that were previously owed. For people whose involuntary termination happened before March 1st, the period of coverage will begin on March 1st if we're talking about monthly coverage periods. For individuals whose eligibility begins after that date, then it'll be whatever date coverage would otherwise terminate. So sort of the exact same rules that we have under COBRA generally. The one other thing that must be included in the notice is a description of whether there is another plan enrollment option. And going on to slide 21, we'll talk about what this means. The rules in the legislation basically give the employer the option of allowing an assistance-eligible individual to enroll in different coverage. And there's limitations on how this works. The general idea is that because the purpose of the legislation is to get more people covered. So they thought, well, maybe one impediment to this is because they previously had elected coverage that was too rich or too expensive for them. So if there is a coverage option that is less expensive, where the premium is less expensive, then maybe they're more likely to choose that or to elect continuation coverage if that other option is available. So employers may, but are not required, to allow these individuals to switch to another enrollment option. And the way this works effectively is that you give the same 60-day notice period, the same election period that would run along with the election for coverage generally, but you would have to describe the other enrollment options, and the qualified beneficiary would have 90 days after the notice to elect this other enrollment option. That might create some inconsistencies in terms of how you administer your plan, because maybe you get one election that says something about I want to elect COBRA, and then another election that says, oh, and I want to change my enrollment option. As a practical matter, hopefully that won't come up too often, but there is that difference in periods of the notice in the notice requirements. In slide 22, we just outline what can be offered as other enrollment options. I think the primary requirements are listed here. It has to be an enrollment option that's offered to active employees, so you're not going to go out and invent a new enrollment option, as much fun as that might be. It has to be different coverage that does not have a higher premium. Again, the purpose here, the goal here, is to make it more available for qualified beneficiaries. So in the government's mind, what would be consistent with that is if they elect, say, a less expensive option or with a less expensive premium, and then the coverage can't be restricted coverage, dental only, vision only, that kind of stuff. And again, that's consistent with the idea that what the government is promoting is this idea that more people have more general medical coverage. What other help is available out there? That's covered on slide 23. As I talked about, the most important thing I think that we're really that all of us here are super excited about is the model notice provided by the Department of Labor. I think that there's probably also going to be some additional guidance that comes along with that, or at very least there's other guidance that will be provided by the Department of Labor. But currently we also have a dedicated website from the Department of Labor that you can check out. We provided that web address. I think that also has the IRS has done a similar thing, and I think that if you go to that link, that you can link to the IRS guidance as well. If not, we can provide that to you. But it has frequently asked questions, and it walks through the new legislation and is really helpful. As Holly mentioned, there's already an updated publication on Form 941, so there's already information with respect to how you're going to work with the subsidy. So this is all super helpful information that's provided out there. But we are still we're still on the learning curve. So I expect that there'll be additional information that's provided. Notice obligations, the last thing that I wanted to touch on was notice obligations of eligible qualified beneficiaries. This, again, it's consistent, it's reinforced by the legislation, but it's consistent with the obligations that qualified beneficiaries have currently under COBRA. And basically, what it says is that eligible assistance individuals have to provide notice when they're no longer eligible for premium assistance. And we get a lot of questions. So the primary, I think the primary thing that we're looking at here, and Holly mentioned, was that an individual is no longer going to be eligible if they become eligible for other group health plan coverage. And that could be just eligibility under a spouse's plan or a lot of other types of eligibility. And we often get questions of like, oh, you know, how are we going to possibly know how this happens or whatever? And you know, and one answer is, well, we might not. You know, I mean, there's a limit to what we can do as employers or what we have to do. But the legislation is very clear, and I think that the model notice will be clear, and definitely I think you should include in your notices this responsibility of the qualified beneficiary to provide you with notice if they become, if they're no longer eligible, and specifically, for instance, if they become eligible for other group health plan coverage. And that's about all we can do, and the way the legislation works is it shifts the burden to the qualified beneficiary, and if they violate this rule, if they don't provide notice, or if they receive the eligibility assistance, the subsidy, the premium assistance, when they're not eligible, then they're going to have to pay a penalty of 110% of that premium reduction. So just as an overview on page 25, the big picture employer compliance checklist, the first question I think you're going to have to ask yourself is, are you an affected employer? And for most of us, or at least I would expect most of you who are continuing to listen at this point, the answer is going to be yes. I don't know how many people we lost during the telephone conference, and how much of that is just due to me droning on about
notice. We're all here for a call.
I was going to say, there you go. But you know, but probably most of you who are listening now are in fact employers. So then the next question becomes, you know, what is the pool of eligible qualified beneficiaries? And as I indicated, you know, we're looking at two different pools for notice purposes. One is the pool of who has to receive notice, and that's generally going to be, you know, all of the qualified beneficiaries from September 1 through December 31st of 2009. But then there's also a subset, and you're going to have to make your own determination to a certain extent as to the subset of who's eligible to receive the subsidy. And you're either going to have to make that determination when you send out election notices if you choose to send it only to a limited set of individuals, or you're going to have to make that determination when they elect coverage. And you're going to, I mean, the employer does have some obligation to say, is this, you know, was this person involuntarily terminated or were they not? The next thing is just satisfying the notice requirements. As I said, you know, what we're doing here, what we're recommending here, is waiting for the model notice. I know I'm very excited. This is going to be one of the most exciting weeks of my life as we wait for the Department of Labor to send out their model notice. Probably tailoring those notices to a certain extent, and then again making sure that we send them out before April 17th, 2009. You also need to you know, establish some administrative procedures for making sure the 65% premium subsidy is paid, and that will depend on, you know, are you a self-insured plan, an insured plan, that type of stuff. Obviously, this has a, you know, at very least a cash flow impact on employers, so this is a real, you know, that's a real issue. And then on the back end, establishing administrative procedures for reimbursement, you know, making sure you complete the 941 and keep records, the records that are going to be required in order to get the subsidy. Obviously, if you pay it up front, you don't want to miss out on getting it back. And then here's, again, a reference to where additional guidance can be found. That is COBRA. Is that COBRA in a nutshell? I think that we probably have questions, so we will continue this presentation for the next 25 minutes or until noon, and, you know, feel free to continue to send your questions in, and we will get right about answering them.
Yeah, we do have questions. In fact, more questions than we could possibly get to. We've got close to 200 now coming in, but many of them, Jason, were along the lines of, well, what if we have somebody who's on COBRA due to they were dependent and they, you know, aged out, they got a divorce, their hours were reduced, do they have to get the notice, and or are they eligible for the extended election or the subsidy?
those are very good questions. To clarify, anyone who became a qualified beneficiary between September 1st, 2008 and December 31st, 2009 is going to get information, is going to get notice about the premium assistance. And there's just, you know, I mean, that's just what the legislation says, and that's just what we have to do. But the people who can elect, and really the targeted people, are going to be those who had an involuntary termination or who are qualified beneficiaries of an individual who had an involuntary termination. So those are the ones that have to be allowed an opportunity to elect. But generally, yeah, we're gonna take the information the Department of Labor provides us or otherwise update our notices, and everybody's going to get information about the premium assistance. And I think the purpose there, what the government was thinking, assuming that this wasn't just a mistake, is that this at least shifts some of the burden or gives an employee that maybe you inadvertently overlooked or a dependent or a spouse that really was a qualified beneficiary because of an involuntary termination, but somehow, you know, the employer overlooks them, they'll get the information and have a chance to at least raise that issue.
Okay, and then we have several variations on the question that actually Liz is going to answer because she's looked at this. What about people who are on some sort of layoff or furlough or inactive status but have not actually been terminated from employment?
Right. Well, at this point in time, the guidance that we have says that there has to be an involuntary termination of employment. Now, as many of you know, a COBRA qualifying event can be a termination of employment, but it can also be a reduction in hours. So if you are actually still employed or considered employed by an employer, but you're not eligible for medical coverage as an employee because you don't have enough hours of service, you are not eligible for the subsidy. We're hoping to get some more guidance on that point because I think it's very important. You feel sort of sorry for people who are not working. Their number of hours of service are zero. But they're still not eligible for the subsidy, and I'm hoping that somebody figures out that that's an oversight in the law as it stands.
Let me throw out another comment on that that I think we made reference to, but the Department of Labor is charged with setting up sort of an appeal right for individuals. So one thing that you may find out of this is either you make a determination that an individual isn't eligible, or they call you up and ask you, and you're sort of like, I don't know, you know, the Department of Labor will have a telephone number that they can call. This should be included in the model notice, and or if you don't use the model notice, you'll have to provide this information. And the Department of Labor is supposed to respond within 15 days. So it sort of shifts the burden, I think fortunately, from the employer on some of these calls to decisions to the Department of Labor. And if the Department of Labor says, yeah, we should cover them, well, then, okay, you know, that's their call. Or no, we don't have to.
I mean, that's an interesting point, Jason, because I think a lot of us are kind of waiting in suspense to see how are they really going to pull that off. I mean, because there could be just lots and lots of questions, and the law does direct that they have to respond within the 15 days, so knowing how that works. I think it also highlights the point you made earlier as to why send the notice to everybody if you know right off not everyone's going to be able to take advantage of it. And I think it's probably for people who maybe have some sort of dispute about whether it was voluntary or involuntary. This at least gives them the notice, and then they could go and raise the claim if they wanted.
I expect the Department of Labor will be hiring a lot of people that maybe have been furloughed or laid off. So.
Well, if it's anything like the experience of the questions coming in here, they'll never be able to keep up. So, several people have asked for more clarification about who exactly has to pay the subsidy or make up for the amount that the employee is not paying. Is it the employer? Is it the insurer? Is it a TPA? And then which of those goes and gets reimbursement from the government?
The payment of the 65% and the reimbursement that follows come from and go to the entity to whom premiums would be paid. And in most cases, that's going to be the employer, and in some cases, it will be the insurer.
Okay, but like, for example, some employers have a TPA who handles their COBRA. They outsource their COBRA to a TPA. just because somebody sends their COBRA premiums to the TPA's mailbox, that doesn't mean that the TPA is responsible for doing it, does it? Or is the TPA responsible?
Right, that's a great clarification. It's the party who is responsible for the payment of premiums. If you have somebody in the mix that's administering, then it would still be the party that's responsible for the payment of premiums. In the case that Jeff just described, it would be the employer.
Yeah, I think for almost everybody listening, it's going to be the employer, unless they're participating in a multi-employer plan, in which case, you know, maybe the plan, or unless we're talking about, you know, one of the state mini COBRA provisions, in which case it could be the insurance company.
Yeah, and I'll add to that, because in Oregon we do have mini COBRA. And it's operated somewhat differently than the mini COBRA rules in California. And I think that at least in Oregon, the Department of Insurance there has not fully addressed. They've kind of punted on the issue and told employers and insurers to work it out. But the question is, under the mini COBRA laws, I think if you look at the statute directly, it requires the insurer, if someone's under the mini COBRA law, that the insurer is fronting the 65% subsidy. However, the way mini COBRA is operated in Oregon, it's just like traditional COBRA, and it runs through the employer. So I know insurers in Oregon, at least some of whom, are saying to the employer, no, we think you have to do it. That's different than in California, where my understanding and what people have told me is that the mini COBRA there, it's more of a direct relationship between the participant and the insurance company, and the employer is somewhat cut out of it. So there it makes more sense to say, yeah, it's the insurer. So I know in some states this is kind of an open issue. It's being discussed. I think, though, if you look at the law clearly says you fall into that kind of state COBRA comparable mini COBRA coverage category. It's the insurer that's supposed to do it.
And for most employers, I would expect most of us listening here today, you know, whether you have a self-insured or insured plan, if you're subject to COBRA, federal COBRA, it's going to be the employer.
Again, we've gotten several variations on questions regarding who's eligible for the subsidy, particularly people who might have terminated before September 1, 2008, but for some reason they had coverage, that their period of coverage didn't end until after September 1, and they didn't actually become eligible for COBRA until after September 1, 2008. Would those people be eligible for the subsidy?
The involuntary termination has to occur between September 1 and December 31st. Now, those people that Jeff just described may be qualified beneficiaries that have to receive notice, which complicates things, because I think those are people who are likely to have questions. But the legislation specifically says that the involuntary termination has to happen between September 1 and December 31st.
Okay. So I guess it's kind of like with the normal COBRA rules. You're looking at what's the COBRA qualifying event, and you may not lose coverage right away after the COBRA qualifying event. I mean, your coverage may continue for a month or two for whatever reason. But typically, for example, the 18 months of coverage relates back to the COBRA qualifying event, which I agree with Jason.
And here the COBRA qualifying event that we're looking at is the involuntary termination appointment, which must occur after September 1st. And to this end, I think as a practical matter, it's helpful to know that, you know, in the case where it's unclear whether or not somebody is eligible or if the circumstances around their termination make them eligible, then you can defer to the Department of Labor, and you have the option of denying, and then the individual can call the Department of Labor and within 15 days ostensibly get a determination, and that protects everybody. So that's an option.
And a related question: if somebody was involuntarily terminated after September 1st, 2008, just to clarify, it doesn't really matter whether they're still in their COBRA election period or it's expired, or they still get the extended COBRA election, correct?
Yes, yeah.
Okay. Let's see. We also had several questions about people coming off of FMLA leave or not returning, I guess, from FMLA leave. And would they be eligible or required to get notice? Would they be eligible for the subsidy?
I think, well, I don't, well, first of all, I would say that there isn't specific guidance on this question. So the legislation doesn't say. But generally, I wouldn't say that not returning from FMLA leave is going to be an involuntary termination. I mean, maybe I'm not thinking about all the possible different circumstances, but generally, if you don't return to work, it's your choice. It's something that the employee is choosing. So maybe there are nuances here or specific circumstances, but that would be my general answer.
And then a question which was in Jason's section about the optional coverage or the option to take other coverage than the one. People just wanted a clarification that they can, if they want to, restrict the COBRA availability to the plan that the person was on at the time that they had their involuntary termination.
Yeah, that's a good clarification. So you don't have to allow them to switch enrollment options. You don't have to allow them to switch from a PPO to an HMO or from, you know, a high deductible or to a high deductible plan or anything like that. This is just, you know, it's an option that the legislation gives the employer if they would like to offer that.
Okay. And if they do then give that option, it effectively increases their election period to 90 days rather than 60 days.
Yes.
One question that that people have asked me, but it's also a question that carries over from just the normal COBRA rules in general. As Holly mentioned, to be an assistance eligible individual, it's an involuntary termination, but not for gross misconduct. And people have asked, okay, well, what does that mean, gross misconduct? Unfortunately, there's not really there's not a law, there's not a statute there that says that. And what the courts have done typically is they say, you know, there's a standard. Sometimes they'll look at comparable rules under workers' compensation laws. But in my experience, it's one of those things that you know it when you see it, and it has to be really, really bad. And that sounds very fuzzy, but I think that's probably the best rule of thumb. You know, if it's something that's really shocking, then courts have tended to say, yeah, that's gross misconduct, but just simply because, say, someone doesn't want to work with Jason because he combs his hair funny, fire him for that, but, you know, that's really not gross misconduct.
And once again, you know, if in doubt, you have the opportunity to reject, and then the individual has 15 days to appeal. So
there is
a safety net there.
Okay. There's another question which needs, I guess, more clarification. Someone was terminated between September 1, 2008 up until the end of February 2009, would they have to pay their total COBRA premiums to bring them up to date, up to the subsidy effective date of March 1?
At the end,
this has to do with the extended election period.
Yeah. To be clear, the way that it will work is, again, let's assume that person didn't elect COBRA, so between September 1 and the end of February, they haven't been covered under COBRA. Their coverage won't begin until March 1st, so they don't have to pay the back premiums. They'll just start paying for March going forward. Now, they might not make the election until, you know, 60 days after April 17th, so there may be, you know, some premiums to get caught up on for March and April, but the coverage will not be retroactive back to September 1st.
That's a good clarification. I could see where some people might be confused, because under the regular COBRA rules, let's say an employer forgets to send out a notice, and the person's ability under COBRA to elect COBRA continuation coverage is tied to receiving the notice. If the employer spaces that, never sends out the notice, say 6 months go by and then they realize what happens, so they send the person the notice, the person could elect now under that notice and could go retroactive and say, okay, I'm going to pay all my back premiums. My COBRA is going to go back to when I had the right, but I didn't get the notice. So in some COBRA situations, you do have people having to pay back premiums to get the rights. But I think Jason's absolutely right. Under the the extended rule, what they're saying is you get kind of a new shot at it, but it's picking up prospectively from the new effective date.
And I think one thing that's important to add here is while it does pick up from the new prospective date, the total period of time for which the individual is eligible for COBRA is not extended. It doesn't start when they take advantage of the new election. It starts when the original qualifying event, i.e. the involuntary termination of employment, occurs. So you can have, if somebody elects, you know, takes the second bite of the apple and elects during the extended notice period, they're not going to have any longer period of COBRA coverage. It's just going to be they're getting on the train. And I think the train analogy is pretty helpful.
Here's another good question. Perhaps will be covered in the DOL notice. Does an employer need to provide a notice to the individual when their 9-month premium assistance period is up? In other words, when they have to start paying 100% instead of 35%?
And that's an interesting question that we've been asked before. And you know, there is no guidance. And you know, as the person who asked the question, you know, maybe there will be guidance in the model notice. Currently, there's no obligation under COBRA to provide, other than with the initial notice, to provide information as to what the premium is. So you don't have an obligation on a monthly basis to tell them what their premium is or to send them a bill or anything along those lines. I think the best guidance we have right now is just, you know, do what is consistent with COBRA. So if you're currently, you know, billing monthly, which you don't have to do, but which employers do sometimes do because it's, you know, it's helpful, then yeah, I would, you know, change those bills to reflect the change in premium. If you know, if you're not providing any information or whatever, you certainly don't have an obligation to, but to provide them notice at the end of the 9-month period. But it may be helpful for them to understand, and it may avoid some confusion if they send you less than the total amount that's already due, but still intend to stay on COBRA.
Okay, and I think there's a request for clarification again. I think this is just because we've been tossing around December 31 sometimes without specifying, but this law applies to people who were terminated after September 1, 2008, all the way through December 31, 2009. So I think some people were confused and thought that somehow they had to be terminated in this period between September 1 and December 31 of 2008. That's not the case. It's still going on. Future layoffs are also going to be affected by this. So
it's a 16-month period starting September 1st, 2008, ending September 31st, 2009.
So someone, say, involuntarily terminated this summer, they would have a right to the COBRA subsidy. They would not, however, have a right to this expanded COBRA election because that was just to pick up people who didn't elect between September 1 and the time that this law came into effect, but that they still, you know, their termination prior to December 31, 2009 is still relevant for purposes of their getting access to the COBRA subsidy.
One last question. This might be a political question you might have to address to someone in Washington, D.C., but we've had it come up several times here. Is this program going to expire December 31st, 2009, or is it going to become a permanent part of COBRA?
We've had that question before, and it's an excellent one. We don't have a firm answer, of course, because we don't have a crystal ball, but it's possible that it could be extended. It's also possible that it could be kind of a stopgap measure until there is larger legislation in the healthcare arena. And for now, we're just kind of taking it like everybody else, just a little bit at a time. So we don't know, but we'll let y'all know as soon as we find out.
What the closest thing I know is from someone who heard from someone who heard from an insider, and that's like a three-part removed rumor, which is that don't be surprised because there may be more to come. I don't know what that means other than it's a possibility.
Okay. Got one more question from a very persistent email listener saying, I'm still listening to make sure if we are bound by the new rule if we have 18 current employees. And this person, one of the people who asked this question was, if their address was in California. Yeah, this one appears to be in Oregon. Yeah,
okay.
Oregon, 503.
Well, if you have 18 current employees, you would not be subject, and I'm assuming you're not a state or local government employer, because then you'd be looking at the Public Health Services Act, but you would not be subject to regular COBRA under either ERISA or the tax code, because there's an exemption there for small employers, and if you've got less than 20, you're exempt. However, in Oregon, as well as in California, they do have mini COBRA laws. So what you want, and those get hardwired into your insurance policy. And so there, yes, there is some continuation. For example, in Oregon, it's 6 months of coverage continuation after a termination of employment. Your policy specifies how that happens. So this law would apply to you with respect to the subsidy portion, not the election portion. So if someone was involuntarily terminated, let's say December, and didn't elect under the COBRA, the Oregon mini COBRA law, they don't have the right to come in and take a second bite of the apple and elect again. But if someone did elect and they're continuing on that, they do have the ability to get the subsidy for their remaining period of mini COBRA coverage.
All right. Well, as I said, we've got a lot more questions. Hopefully some of these we'll be able to save and get back to people after the seminar, but I'd like to turn it over to Liz for some concluding remarks.
Well, I think Stuart said it best. Stay tuned, because there's more to come. It's a very rapidly changing area. We thank you all for attending. If you have any specific questions, you're obviously welcome, and welcome to call us individually. We'd be happy to answer them and talk with you. We'll be in touch. Thanks.
Thank you.
And again, this is Claire Conference. Thank you all for joining. We shall be off for you.